Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who have a greater dose of intelligence, in my experience, and certainly more experience in the application of it for our national security than my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Vice President for Government Relations, Michael Waller. Dr. Waller is a man who has distinguished himself in academia, including at the Institute of World Politics. He has been very active in journalism, as well as in authoring books and articles and otherwise contributing very actively to the public policy debate. We spoke with him earlier in the week and thought that it would probably be necessary to get him back on quickly, and indeed it has proven to be, because there have been some very important developments in the portfolio that he is particularly expert in, and that is Russia, and, well, for that matter, before it, the Soviet Union, and characteristics, qualities, capabilities, and agendas that have seemingly survived the transition from the communist era to the kleptocratic Putin era. It's great to have him back in the house virtually. Michael Waller, welcome back.
Hey, Frank. It's good to be back.
Since we talked earlier in the week, Michael, there have been, as I mentioned, some interesting developments specifically with respect to this so-called Uranium One scandal. And that term is now being used even, I believe, by the folks like the Washington Post. Imagine that. Something that was not true until fairly recently. Tell us why the Post, among others now, is paying considerably more attention to this story than they had until now.
Well, they ignored it for so long, they couldn't hide it anymore. And with the new media going out there and scooping the Washington Post left and right, they finally have no choice but to acknowledge what everybody else knows is obvious.
And what is obvious is?
What is obvious is that in 2010 and 2011, Bill and Hillary Clinton, as Hillary was Secretary of State, colluded with the Russians and with business interests that are directly tied, joined at the hip to the Kremlin, and in order to make sure that a state-owned Russian enterprise that manufactures nuclear weapons would be able to get 20% of our uranium production.
20% of our uranium production is a lot, it would appear. It also is of rather strategic importance, is it not? Would you talk a little bit about what the concept of this play was and whether it, in fact, has national security overtones?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, just from an energy perspective, why in the world would the United States be allowing the Russian government ministry that's in charge of nuclear energy and in designing and manufacturing nuclear weapons, why would we ever find it in our interest to sell them the uranium that they're going to use to nuke us with?
The feedstock, in other words, for nuclear threats to this country.
Right. And so why in the world would we think that's fine? And the fact that the Obama administration saw no national security threat in this is just staggering. Another thing is the FBI was on top of this the whole time. They had the most brilliant counterintelligence operation in American history, going after a ring of deep cover Russian spies, 11 of them, and busted them, arrested 10 of them. Right at the time Bill was in Moscow, Bill Clinton, doing this $500,000 Kremlin speech. It just staggers the imagination that there had been very little real journalistic interest in this in the mainstream media until alternative media broke the story. Oh, and to its credit, really, the New York Times, but they got the information from our friend Peter Schweitzer, who had researched this very carefully in his book, Clinton Cash.
Indeed. And that's part of the story here, is that Peter laid all this out prior to the election, and there was scrupulously little attention paid by the mainstream media. And indeed, but for those alternative outlets, I think it's fair to say, it wouldn't have gotten much play. Again, the Clinton Cash, the book certainly did in its immediate, you know, post-publication run. But thereafter, and certainly in terms of accountability, there really wasn't much until at least now. Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has just in the past day or so announced that he thinks what is going on here, Michael, whether it's the Uranium One caper or the fact that the FBI knew about it and did nothing to stop it, the fact that this group called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States nonetheless rubber stamped the deal, perhaps at least some of the members not knowing about this backstory of corruption with the Clintons, but some, including Eric Holder, presumably doing so. He wants to get into this, I think both in terms of his own committee, but also a special prosecutor. Does this surprise you, first of all, I guess, that finally Congress seems to be bestirring itself and taking an interest in all this? And secondly, do you think a special prosecutor is warranted?
Well, first, yes, a special prosecutor is warranted because these crimes, this is like Julius and Ethel Rosenberg giving atomic bomb secrets to Stalin. It really ranks with that when you have a sitting American Secretary of State and her husband, who's the former president of the United States, who are literally peddling influence in order to benefit the Russian military.
Well, if it were just peddling influence, it was peddling, you know, feedstock for their weapons program, for God's sake. Yeah, that makes the Rosenberg parallel more apt.
I mean, at least the Rosenbergs were communists who believed in their cause. The Clintons are just doing it out of pure greed. And so where you have, and you know it's a pay-to-play influence operation because you don't see this kind of dough rolling into the Clinton Foundation anymore. So it was purely to help Vladimir Putin's regime for cash. And then this whole narrative came out during the campaign from Hillary Clinton herself, saying that Donald Trump is Putin's puppet and so forth. So that's what makes the whole DNC document scandal with Fusion GPS so important right now, because you have, on the one hand, clear collaboration with the Kremlin to influence U.S. decisions for cash, followed by allegations that Donald Trump is Putin's puppet, to complete diversion away from what was really happening.
A classic leftist strategy, of course. Let's turn, Michael, to that other story. Should a special prosecutor also be looking into the fact that the Clintons and the Democratic National Committee actually engineered with a former British spy and, you know, information operators, I guess it's fair to call them, or perhaps worse, in Moscow, an opposition research program that was very clearly designed to focus attention on Trump and alleged Russian collusion, apparently out of whole cloth.
Yeah, and it's a shame, though, that you can't trust the FBI to investigate this anymore. Ordinarily, you say, let's let the FBI handle it, and we'll trust them. The FBI has abused the public trust. Congress, Paul Ryan hasn't allowed these investigations to happen. And when you have somebody like Senator Chuck Grassley taking the lead, you know that there's a problem, because Charles Grassley is not a man who's easily riled up. He's a really calm guy. He's a pretty moderate guy. And to have him taking the lead on this is really, really spectacular. And to hear the very blunt things he's been saying is very unusual. So I think having him doing a lot of the investigation with support or a parallel separate investigation from an independent counsel, that's really the way to get to the bottom of this. And of course, Frank, we at the center have been calling for this forever anyway. And even once Trump was elected, we said Trump should welcome these widespread investigations, because it's not going to lead much, if anything, to Trump and his people. It's going to lead to Hillary. All we have to do is just follow the breadcrumbs. And of course, now we find it happening almost a year after the fact.
Well, and that's a year that's been lost, I'm afraid, and considerable damage done to the reputation of the president. And it would appear to the national security, if only because we have been so distracted by a real threat to this country's, common defense. I think there's no other way to describe it. Mike Weller, we're going to ask you to stick around for a second segment, if you will. We're going to pause now for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk a bit more about the politicizing of the intelligence community, as you see it, Michael. You mentioned the FBI. We can't trust it anymore. This problem is bigger than that, and the DNC is a prime example of the problem. That and more with Michael Weller at the Center for Security Policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Michael Weller, the Vice President of the Center for Security Policy for Government Relations, is with us in house virtually, as they say. We're talking about some developments just in the past couple of days since we last spoke to Mike about this Clinton scandal, the real collusion with the Russians that evidently was taking place within her circle, her Secretary of State organization, her campaign organization, the Democratic National Committee. And Mike, I wanted specifically to drill down with you a bit on the Democratic National Committee, the DNC as it's known. I was stupefied to learn that when there were these allegations that the Russians had hacked into the DNC's servers to steal confidential information and embarrassing emails and the like, that the FBI took the word of a company with, interestingly enough, Russian ties, rather than do its own forensic research, because the DNC wouldn't let them do it, their own research into what was actually done to those servers that that compromised them. Talk, if you would, about what we've learned on that score and what it says about, well, the FBI, for example, but perhaps other agencies, the United States government as well, and the compromising thereof by the Russians.
Well, first, you think, take any normal citizen and they say, wow, I have got reason to believe that the Russians might have been hacking important things on my server or using my server for nefarious reasons. I think I'll call the FBI and let them check it out. That's a normal citizen response, but not in the case of the Democrat National Committee. And at the same time, if the FBI has information indicating that Russian spies or organized criminals have been using servers in the United States for criminal or spy purposes, the FBI is entitled under the law to go in and seize them. Neither of those things happened. The Democrat National Committee did not offer the FBI the servers, and the FBI did not seize the servers.
Normally, people would volunteer to have the servers examined by the FBI, and in any event, the FBI can simply seize such servers as part of a forensic investigation. It didn't happen in this case. Can you tell us why?
No, I can't tell you why. It's a big mystery, but it fits a pattern. Because when it was discovered that Hillary Clinton, while she was Secretary of State, had her own private servers in the bathroom of her house in Westchester County, New York, the FBI did not go after those servers either, and she did not offer them. In fact, it wasn't until I broke the story in Investor's Business Daily where I got multiple source confirmation from within the FBI that the FBI had not even requested the server, that the FBI finally went in and got that server. So this is a pattern we're seeing within the FBI concerning Hillary Clinton, where they did not want to investigate her.
And this again fits the story we were talking about before we paused for this segment, that the FBI knew about corruption. They were actively investigating the Clintons in connection with the Uranium One enterprise, and they did nothing there too. There is a pattern here for sure, and it seems to me Chuck Grassley is right. We do need to have a special prosecutor getting into this, because we certainly know that the former director of the FBI, Bob Mueller, who is now a special prosecutor of this Will of the Wisp campaign against Trump, can't be relied upon. He's implicated in this, as is his successor, Jim Comey, as is the deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe. as is Rod Rosenstein, the now Deputy Attorney General. I mean, this is unbelievable, Mike. And it really cries out for, as we've been talking about, both intensified congressional oversight as well as a special prosecutor. Michael, what can you tell us about this Fusion GPS organization? I gather you've had some dealings with them over the years.
Yes, not with the company itself, but with one of the with Glenn Simpson, one of the founder and principals. Yeah, and he was a good investigative journalist who actually investigated a lot of Russian organized crime work and helped the Justice Department in the past. And somewhere along the way, he went bad, and he started doing the Russians' work for them, and he was doing it for money, and he was spreading disinformation for clients. Not simply a journalist who decides to become a private investigator. That's fine, but when you're spreading disinformation, that's a totally different thing. That's crossing the line in a terrible way.
And Russian disinformation at that, and at the very moment that you're claiming that the Russians have been disinforming us in connection with their efforts to, you know, get Donald Trump elected. It is, and Mike, you've been a student as well as a practitioner of political warfare for a long time. I think a first-order example of how this works at the hands of sophisticated practitioners like the Kremlin. Is there any further takeaway in terms of what we should be doing now with respect to the Russians that arises out of all of this?
Oh, lots of takeaways there. First, the problem is, and we have to expect the Russians to do this. That's normal. This is Russia just being Russian, and we just have to be wary of that, which for all these years we were not as a nation. At the center of security policy we were, but most others know. But in the case of us as Americans choosing not to be aware and denouncing those who raise these points and ignoring evidence, that's very different. So the fault, it really starts right here at home, where we had even Republican political leaders in the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, told the committee chairman, we don't want you to investigate Hillary Clinton. You just had a member of Congress say that over the weekend. So now they're finally going to have hearings on this. So why is it that the Republican leadership in Congress did not want Hillary Clinton investigated? That's just bizarre.
It is bizarre. Only it seems as though it may have something to do with their enmity towards Donald Trump. I hate to say that, but there's a lot of evidence of that on the Hill these days, isn't there? Hey, Mike, let me, in the closing moments, ask you about something else. I know you have appreciated probably better than just about anybody another form of political warfare that is being waged here in the United States. The left, I'm not sure whether it's the Russians exactly, but perhaps they're involved as well, but certainly engines of the hard left, like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Islamists, the so-called Red-Green Axis, have been very aggressively seeking to stifle the free speech of people like us, for that matter, but many others besides. And Mike, I wanted to just take note of the fact that an outstanding organization, Prager University, a project of Dennis Prager's organization, has now sued Google and YouTube for playing sort of handmaiden to these groups that are trying to silence folks like us. Talk very quickly, if you would, about that and its importance.
Well, it's a question here where you have Google is very ideological, and you know, the left coast people, most of the engineers really don't care, but the management extremely ideological. And what they have done is they have rigged their algorithms to skew search results to make certain things come up top, whether it's negative about people like you and me or positive about friends of theirs like the SPLC, and then to link those results to make their political opponents look as bad as possible. There's a distinct pattern on this, and I think Prager University has caught on to it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be taking the huge risk of tackling Google with a lawsuit.
Well, it's high time that somebody did. I'm so proud of them for taking the lead. I hope that we can help support them in the course of this pursuit of just basically the preservation of our most fundamental freedom, freedom of expression. Mike, we appreciate you coming on the show to express yourself with regularity and for all the work you do at the Center for Security Policy these days. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with another of our distinguished colleagues, Kevin Freeman, one of the country's preeminent experts on economic warfare. What those who are waging it have in mind for you. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Kevin Freeman. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and a guy that we consult with regularly because he has, well, the whole world in his hands, as they say, at least with respect to his appreciation, indeed his deep mastery of the phenomenon of economic warfare. He these days blogs a terrific online resource, globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also contributing mightily through other vehicles, notably two terrific books on the subject of economic warfare. The first, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. We spoke with Kevin earlier in the week, but there's so much news going on in his part of the battle space that we asked him to come aboard for two more deep dive segments, and I'm very appreciative. Kevin, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you, Frank.
Let me ask you, Kevin, about an issue that has been dogging us for some time, and that is the Iran nuclear deal. President Obama, of course, bequeathed this to us. I call it, as a result, the Obama bomb deal. He, in the process, created a sort of economic vortex, that's the way I think of it, supplying the Iranians with something on the order of $150 billion in kind of found money, some of which, at least, the Iranians are using to bribe European and, for that matter, other companies and governments to do business with them, to invest in Iran, to buy Iranian products, to sell the Iranians products manufactured elsewhere. Talk a little bit, if you would, Kevin Freeman, from an economic warfare point of view, whether not only is this really an example of that kind of warfare practiced by the Iranians, but arguably by our so-called friends in Europe as well, as they're playing along.
Well, Frank, you know, the Europeans have resented us for our stance with the Iranians for quite some time, even though we are protecting them as much as we're protecting ourselves. It goes back to Standard Chartered, the bank that had internal emails, and they were literally laundering money for the Iranians. They were hiding the source of it in their banks here in the United States, complete violation of rules, and they got caught. And when the evidence came out, they were putting, you effing Americans, who are you to tell us what to do with Iran? Well, they want access to our banking markets and they want access to our consumer markets, but they want everything on their terms. And the Iranians are using the money, the $150 billion or so that they got from unfrozen assets that were released to them. They've used that to bring all sorts of European companies into doing business so that it would prevent any possibility of ever putting sanctions on again. It was a bomb. It was an Obama bomb that was placed on our economy, and it's to the detriment of American consumers. It's to the detriment of American companies, and it's really a grave threat to the whole world.
Yeah, well, and our security as well, not least as this nuclear weapons program in Iran moves forward inexorably, covertly at least, and of course has accompanying it, the growing capacity of the Iranians to deliver such weapons to our shores. Frightening thought. Again, this seems to fit, as I was talking about with Michael Waller in the previous segments, a pattern of indifference to American security. And we were promised a course correction. I'm sorry to say there hasn't been nearly as much of that as I had hoped, and I think many American voters had bargained for under Donald Trump. But you have pointed out one area in which he has been making a very salutary difference, Kevin Freeman. Talk a bit, if you would, about the no net new regulation strategy that Donald Trump has been applying in the aftermath of the Obama sort of regulatory state overgrowth.
Well, there's an excellent article on this in the Weekly Standard by Peter Boyer that titled Donald Trump, King of Deregulation. The fact is that for the past two administrations, we've been averaging 13,000 new regulations a year, actually for the past 20 years. And yet under the Trump presidency, we've had no net new regulations. So they've eliminated as many regulations as they brought in, which was a campaign promise and one the president has actually kept.
And in particular, you have pointed out, perhaps the Weekly Standard did as well, the as I said, salutary effects of this policy with respect to the EPA. Could you explore that with us a little bit?
Yes. The head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, has ended the practice of sue and settle, which was when the Environmental Protection Agency couldn't get action from the Congress that, to their liking. They couldn't get the Congress to force regulation in an area or give them authority in an area. They actually encouraged lawsuits from environmental groups that would bring that lawsuit, and then they'd go to court and they'd settle, oh, we will agree to create this new regulation and that will solve the problem. And it was essentially caving to the environmentalist groups. The problem with that from an economic warfare perspective is that Vladimir Putin and the Chinese and others realized that they could control American industry through these sue and settle arrangements. So they funded environmental groups who would then bring about a lawsuit. This is Russian collusion as much clearer than any other challenge, you know, than anything else that we've talked about. They literally were controlling the destiny of American business and how they operate it. And the Trump administration has put a stop to it.
And again, Kevin Freeman, as we've discussed often in the past, Vladimir Putin has made no secret of his desire to destroy at least our fracking industry. And I gather that that was a particular focus of this environmental suing practice that he sponsored. Is that right?
Oh, there's no question. But the side effect of it is all of these net new regulations have dropped our economic growth by about 2% per year. And so the Trump administration is putting an end to this. It's a very strong pro-domestic energy policy. It's putting the EPA back on target where they ought to be in protecting Americans and not doing the work of foreign nations. And it's giving the opportunity for our economy to grow again. So this is one place, even the Weekly Standard, which has not necessarily been a fan of the president, has said, whatever you think of the president, he's governing, his administration is governing in a conservative fashion, and this is a prime example of that.
Yeah. I guess what this comes down to in part is he's governing in those areas where he can exercise executive authority, where he has to have help from the Congress. Of course, that help has generally not been forthcoming. The source now of considerable consternation, as you know, Kevin Freeman, as some of these members, particularly of the United States Senate, become very naked in their hostility to the president and a desire to take down his administration. And I'm not talking about Chuck Schumer and the Democrats. I'm talking about senior Republicans, notably people like Bob Corker of Tennessee, Jeff Flake of Arizona, John McCain of Arizona as well, for that matter. Kevin, we're going to have to pause in just a moment. When we come back, I would like to ask you about your thinking about the use of trade negotiations or agreements as an instrument of economic warfare as well. I think most of us, at least at an intellectual level, are quite enamored of the idea, the principle that free trade will lift all boats, as they say. But less than free trade, less than genuine, authentic free trade is a whole nother kettle of fish, if I can mix my metaphors. We'll pick up on that and much more with Kevin Freeman in our second segment with him straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are visiting with our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, our economic warfare specialist, a go-to resource for us and many in government, the media, and elsewhere, the forthcoming star of the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is also the author of two terrific and best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin, we were talking briefly about economic warfare as it is manifesting itself in our time, often at the hands of hostile states like, Russia and China as well. I would be very interested in your current reading in the aftermath of this extraordinary 3.5-hour exposition by Xi Jinping, the communist president, perhaps now president for life. It looks as though he's trying to really take matters entirely into his own hands there. But what he's saying about restoring the eminence of China, the power of China, the influence of it at our expense, and the role that trade is playing in that regard, not so free.
Well, first, I would point out the irony that there are journalists that are fawning all over him with his put China first policy. Well, they look at the president, he says put America first, and he's the devil. Of course, the Chinese are promoting, they want us to be free trade in our orientation, and they're not free trade on their side. And even when we enter into agreements that appear to be free trade, it's like whack-a-mole, because we can agree that we're going to trade freely, but if we don't control currencies at the same time, then their manipulation will show up in the case of manipulating the currency to achieve their trade objectives. So free trade's a great idea. It's something that David Ricardo in the 19th century talked about. And he's right that if everybody is acting in a free trade fashion, it works really well. Everybody's maximized. And it works well in the United States. We have free trade between Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas and New York and Montana and California. There's free trade between the states, but we have a common currency. We have a common culture. When we're talking on the international standpoint, we'll talk about free trade, but our enemies, China being an adversary at least, will manipulate the trade practices to their own advantage.
Remind us about these Chinese colonels who sort of laid out the blueprint they're following, and specifically how American companies have been faring as they try to get in or stay in the vast China market.
Yeah, well, I have this book that I carry with me everywhere. It's titled Unrestricted Warfare. It was published in 1999, and it is a plan to make China preeminent in the world and make remove America from that position. And I'll give you a perfect example. Absolutely, we want free trade. So Microsoft, we want you to come in and sell us your software in China. And that's fantastic. By the way, we're worried about the security of our customers here. So you have to show us the entire security architecture of your software and literally give us the keys to it so that we can protect our consumers. And we bow and give them that. And what we've done is we've just transferred our strategic advantage intellectual property to the Chinese. We don't have the reverse when they come and sell goods and services here. And example for that is Kaspersky from Russia. You know, we buy their service, and next thing you know is Kaspersky is taking the NSA tools and hacking tools off of an NSA contractor's computer or wherever it was placed, and now they're made available to the Russians.
It kind of boggles the mind that this is not something that American businessmen and, you know, the government officials who seek to help them aren't actually taking more seriously. Certainly Donald Trump ran for office on that platform. Steve Bannon feels very strongly about it, but this has not exactly been the leitmotif of American policy prior to this administration, for sure, and less so than I would have liked to see during its course so far. Kevin Freeman, let me ask you about this One Belt, One Road scheme of Xi Jinping's. How does that fit into the larger economic warfare agenda and practices of communist China?
Well, there's no question that Xi Jinping has the intention of making China the dominant. They've made it very public. They pronounce it all the time, and they're using every piece of economic clout that they have. And, you know, it's essentially the modern Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road initiative. And it's an opportunity for them to build out in other nations around them and get economic chits that they will then call in when they do, so that, you know, all of Asia is beholden to them, and eventually all the whole world, Africa and other. So it is their investment in order to achieve their objectives. If we did this, we would be seen as empire builders and we would be denounced.
Kevin, what are the other places where we're watching China's activities contributing materially to our insecurity? In a way, it involves economics again, because they are massively supporting, indeed, I think without their support, there would be no North Korea at all. But they are certainly enabling this regime in Pyongyang to threaten us increasingly. And not only economically, it should be said, but also by transferring militarily relevant technology, including nuclear relevant technology, ballistic missiles and the like. As you look at this, Kevin Freeman, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how we might contend with it. And I would take note that we were both at a luncheon today at which one of our colleagues, Suzanne Schulte, who runs a marvelous program at the Defense Forum Foundation aimed at helping the North Korean people achieve their liberation. But she emphasized the importance of public information and our ability to project it into places like North Korea through outlets like Free North Korea Radio, a private sector initiative, exceedingly cost effective. What are your thoughts on both what we could be doing about the threats that we're facing, thanks in part to the Chinese from North Korea, and in particular in this part of the battle space, public diplomacy, as it's sometimes called, information operations?
Well, a couple of things. One is the Chinese, despite the expectation that they would be reducing trade with North Korea, they've actually increased it substantially this year. I don't know exactly why or what's behind that, but we need to put pressure on China to reduce. They did support the sanctions with the United Nations, but they've now defended that they've increased trade. And so we need to push on that. And one of the things that we learned today at lunch is clearly China does not want to nuclearize the entirety of Asia. And yet the Japanese and others, if North Korea continues down that process, then other Asian nations will want to have nuclear weapons capabilities. And that's not in China's interest. And we need to help them denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. But in terms of helping us economically, the North Korean people have been sold a bill of goods that the United States has been harming them. The reason that they have poor economic conditions is because of the United States, that we've been, you know, sinking the rice boats that are going there and so forth. We've got to get our message into North Korea. We've got to broadcast and get information. We're actually friends of the North Korean people. We need them to understand that we care about. So we've got to promote human rights violations and make those known around the world and let the North Korean people know we care. This is important to us. And I think we can make a difference using those information means.
Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, for the work you do with us. And also, folks, check out his extraordinarily important contributions at globaleconomicwarfare.com. We'll continue this conversation in the near future, my friend. In the meantime, I hope we'll continue our conversation with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.